I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show.
Hi, this is Howard Jacobson, and I am thrilled to be joined on the phone today by John Robbins. Hello, John.
Hello, Howard. How are you doing?
Very well. So I want to start by telling you a story I imagine you've heard tens of thousands of times, which starts out with the phrase, "Your book changed my life." So in my case, I was 24. My father had just died of a heart attack following what we thought was a successful remission from prostate cancer. I was overweight, depressed, despondent, not particularly energized about anything, and I stumbled into a bookstore and found Diet for a New America. God knows why I opened it, took it down. I had no interest in the topic. And within 3 weeks, I had gone from size 34 to size 31 waist. I felt better than I had felt my entire life. And I saw clearly, that my purpose was to help spread this message and help people be healthy and happy. So I want to begin by honoring that work and by thanking you for writing it.
Well, thank you, and for that appreciation, and I'm glad that Diet for a New America was of use to you and has inspired you in this way, and now you have, along with our dear friend, mutual dear friend, D. Colin Campbell, co-written a book that is changing many, many, many lives now. Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, is a beautiful piece of work, and I'm really grateful to you for how you've taken the baton and carried it on.
Well, thank you. I guess we're all seeds in the ground, and the next plant keeps growing and
producing more seeds, and this is how the activism of our time really is functioning. It's, you know, one heart opens the next, and one person's willingness and courage in living differently than maybe they had grown up doing or the culture expects of them, but is more authentic and more healthy to do that. And then that their example is contagious, and that one teaches the next, and gradually it builds, and hopefully it attains enough of us that we can turn the tide.
Yep, as much as I look for sort of global trends and marketing techniques, it does come down to one heart touching another.
It does, and that's, I've often thought that the fundamental unit of social change is actually the human heart.
Hmm. Yes, I can. I feel my chest rising when I hear that, so it must be true. So you mentioned courage. So, and I, you know, you have a great story. And I think I'd like, you know, for people, most people who are going to listen to this have heard your story in some detail, but I'd like to explore some things about it that I've been curious about. And I wonder if you could just sort of tell us the nutshell version of how you went from, you know, heir to an ice cream fortune to where you ended up.
Okay, I'll tell the nutshell version as concisely as I can, because I'm eager to get to what the questions you have are. But for those of our listeners who aren't familiar, my dad and uncle were the founders and owners of Baskin-Robbins, 31 flavors, which became the world's largest ice cream company while I was growing up. And while I was growing up, my father groomed me to succeed him. He always expected, he assumed really, that I would follow in his footsteps and one day run the company. My uncle Bert Baskin, my dad's partner and brother-in-law, died of a heart attack, like your dad did at a pretty early age, as apparently your dad did. He was 54. I don't know how old your father was.
He was 71, but
okay.
But quite vigorous. I was still shocked.
That's still a shock. Well, my uncle was 54, and it was even more of a shock because of his age, and I chose to walk away for a variety of reasons from my father's expectations and from the family business, and as well from my dad's wealth, because I wanted to live in integrity. And I knew that that required me to dissociate myself from any connection to my father's financial achievements. And so I did do that, and I walked away from the ice cream cone-shaped swimming pool in our backyard and the opportunity to have immense wealth, to live a very different life by different values, out of which I ended up writing Diet for New America and other books, and speaking about and being an activist on behalf of a healthier, more compassionate way of life, and particularly our abilities to heal our bodies and the world with food.
Okay, beautiful. So one of the questions that someone asked me today when I told them that we had this call scheduled, and I had kind of given them that some version of that nutshell, they said, well, why did he walk away? And I realized I didn't know the answer, and I can't remember whether I just forgot or...
Well, there were a variety of reasons, all of them pointing in the same direction. Certainly my uncle's death, Bert Baskin's death at that young age, shook me up. He was a very big guy who ate a lot of ice cream, and when it happened, I asked my father if he thought there could be a connection between the amount of ice cream that my uncle would eat, which was a great deal, and his fatal heart attack in his early 50s. And my father said, no, absolutely not. His ticker just got tired and stopped working. Hmm. And the message in the subliminal message, the unstated message, was, don't you ever bring that up again. I realized that my dad could not even consider the possibility there could be a connection. By that time, he had manufactured and sold more ice cream than any human being had ever lived on this planet. He couldn't bear the thought mm-hmm. that there might be a connection between ice cream and heart disease. But I suspected there was, and I needed to, if not discuss that with my dad, because he wasn't open to it, I needed to investigate and explore and find out for myself. And the more I learned, the more I realized ice cream is not only not a health food, it's really damaging. It's really not good for you. I mean, an ice cream cone isn't going to kill anybody, and I'm not at war with ice cream, but the more you eat, the more likely you are to have a heart attack like killed my uncle, Bert Baskin, to develop diabetes like my father did develop, a very serious form of it, or become obese and diabetic and all these things that happens to so many people in our society. And of course, if you're selling Baskin Robbins ice cream, or if you're living off the revenue from the sale of it, you want people to eat as much as possible and buy as much as possible. That is the business model. And I didn't want to participate in that business model. I didn't want to sell a product or benefit from the sale of a product that was harming anybody at all. And you know, it's not just Baskin Robbins, by the way. Most of our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And Ben Cohen, who was the co owner of that company for many, many years and the co-founder, as a beautiful human being. He had a quintuple bypass in his late 40s. And Ben Cohen, like my Uncle Burt Baskin, is a very big man who ate a lot of ice cream. And this is what happened.
Hmm. So you were fairly young, right? You hadn't, spent a decade in the CEO chair. You were sort of a, I'm guessing you were in your 20s when you...
I was in my early 20s when a choice point occurred. A company came to Baskin-Robbins with an offer to buy it for a tremendous amount of money, and my dad was torn. He knew that if he sold it, he would remain as president and chairman of the board and be set financially for the rest of his life at a kingly level, to say the least. But he'd lose control over it to some degree and gradually lose more and more as time went along. Whereas if he retained ownership, he would not lose control. And he had hope still of working with me and the two of us being a team. And so he brought the issue to me and said, if it appeared to him that I was moving in a different direction, but this was a choice point, this was a moment of truth, and if I thought there was any chance I would come back and work with him, he would not sell the company. But if I was sure that I wasn't going to come back, then he would. And I told him, this is a relief for me. This actually takes a weight off my shoulders. And I would suggest that you do sell it because I this is not my path in life. And he looked at me and said, why? He was very upset. And I said, well, we live in a different world than when you grew up. It's a different economy now. The gap between the haves and the have-nots is increasing all the time, and I don't feel more secure. I don't think that creates more security for anybody at whatever level of economic class they're functioning. And I also don't think it creates a sense of community. I think it tears it apart. We live under a nuclear shadow now where at any moment the unspeakable could happen. We live in a time when the environment is degrading intensely and increasingly under the impact of human activities. We live in a time when there are children dying of hunger by the tens of thousands every day, while elsewhere there's abundant food resources going to waste and fed to cattle and feedlots, so we can eat hamburgers that are a quarter cent cheaper, and our cholesterol levels that are already too high can be driven even higher. And I said, under these circumstances, for me, inventing a 30-second flavor just would not be an adequate response for my life.
Hmm. So one of the questions I have scribbled here on my preparation notes is whether you were scared to say no to all that. And I'm wondering whether that what you just told me answered the question, that you were actually far more scared of other things.
I think that's the way to put it. I think I was far more scared of other things. And I was scared of living an empty life. I was scared of living an inauthentic life. I was scared of not being true to myself. I was scared of betraying my integrity. I was scared of being succumbing to the money and the lure of a tremendous amount of money. And in the process of that, succumbing, dying inside. That's what scared me the most. And so, people have asked me, how could you give up that level of financial security? And the answer is actually because when I did it, ironically, I felt more emotionally secure. I felt more true to who I am. I felt that I was finally not placating my father's expectations, but instead living in accord with and seeking to develop the gifts inside me and my potential and my destiny.
I love that because there's so much of your story that... I mean, it has inspired many people, and so as a marketer, I certainly appreciate the value of a good story, but the story is really one of kind of this selfless heroism, and what I hear you saying is that you really didn't have a choice.
I honestly didn't. I at a very deep level. I mean, I suppose I did at one point. I could have gone into denial about everything, and just eaten ice cream and gotten rich. But I that's just no way to live. for me, and I had felt too much pain already in my life, and that would be in vain if I just went on a business as usual type of path. And my wife of 47 years, Dea, was with me at that time, and she wasn't surprised at all when the moment of truth arrived and my father had that meeting with me, and I told him, please sell, I'm not coming back. And she I told her, I came home from the dinner and told her what had happened. She said, of course. I mean, she knew me. So it was a key moment, and yet the handwriting was on the wall. I really knew that I had a different destiny. You know, I didn't know, though, Howard. I didn't know what it was. I knew I had to just put one foot in front of the other. I had to live it a day at a time, even a breath at a time, and just do what felt true and real and life-affirming, and follow that my inner guidance or higher wisdom or inner power or higher power or whatever language people have for their that moral compass they have inside. I think we all do, that kind of points us towards true north, where our direction really, really should be. Mm-hmm. And I tried to learn how to tune into my inner voice and understand what was possible for me and where I was being called, and to go where I was being called by spiritual values, and live by higher principles than those that normally prevail in our society, which are the values of materialism for the most part.
Mm. And yeah, and it's striking that you said, you know, I didn't know where I was going to go from there, and then, you know, I guess, I mean, about 10 years later, you kind of show up with like an army at the gates of the kingdom. Like,
who would have known? I surely would not have expected it, but I did end up writing Die for New America, and it became a phenomenon, a huge bestseller, and my mother said, did you write this book just to hurt us? And I said, Mom, no, it's not about you, actually. It's about modern meat production and how our food choices affect our health and our happiness and really the future of life on Earth. It's about how we could live a much healthier life and than we do, and a healthier one in terms of our relationship to animals and the whole web of life on Earth and the resource system that we depend upon for our economy and for everything else that we do. And it's really about bringing our lifestyles back into harmony with what gives us life. She just looked at me and said, well, you're not going to cook tofu in my kitchen. She was hard to win over, but my dad did change. He changed a lot more than my mom. He held out for a while, but then he got very ill, and his cardiologist told him what he really should do if he wanted to get better, was to read my book, and handed him a copy, and my poor father, you know, here's the man who to him is the high priest of Western medicine, a very highly paid cardiologist in Rancho Mirage, California, telling him he should read the book written by his maverick son, who basically rejected his life work and walked away from the money that he had earned. And I mean, it just blew his mind. but later on, he made a lot of changes, and his diabetes went into remission as a result of them. He used to say, well, I'm not a card-carrying vegetarian, as if it were something out of McCarthy. But I... We did a lot of reconciliation in the later years of his life, and he actually said to me one day, he said, you know what bothers me the most about you, Johnny? And I said, no, tell me what bothers you the most about me. And he said, it's that everybody else I've ever met has their price, and you don't. And I thought, I think he just complimented me in his backhanded way, you know?
I think he thought he complimented you too.
Yeah. but it was fun, and I was able to be an unconditional relationship in his life, maybe the only one, in that he was very, very wealthy, and he lived in a way that was conspicuous about that. And everybody was wanting, you know, a check from him and playing for his money, and he was surrounded by people doing things for him that he wrote checks to. And even members of our family, you know, he supported everybody except me. And so if I called him up and just asked how he was doing or told him I loved him or just checked in with him, he knew that it wasn't a front for trying to get money from him. And that's what I mean by I may have been the only unconditional relationship in his life. And it served us, a level of honesty developed between us in the later years that I don't think would ever have happened otherwise.
Mm. And I, as I put myself in both of your shoes, I don't know if I could have walked away from what you walked away from, but I'm pretty sure I couldn't have admitted that my son was right. I don't mean to diminish your accomplishments, but I kind of think your dad kind of did something that I find even more courageous.
Well, I agree with you, and you know, he his whole identity was Mr. Ice Cream. I mean, he did have the ice cream cone swimming pool built in his backyard and everything, but I actually admire him more for that ability that you're describing. Than I do for all of his business achievements, although they are prodigious, because this was of the heart. This was an act of, there's no ego involved in this. In fact, it's kind of ego subordinating for him to say, after all those years, and that my work actually was worthwhile and that I might have been right. In fact, he actually did say at one point, the most amazing thing that he'd ever experienced in his life was, the most incredible thing, was that it ended up that I was right. That was very sweet for me. You know, I think I ended up giving him something. You know, I disappointed him terribly at one point by walking away. But in the long run, I think I ended up giving, I like to think, I ended up giving him something that was even more valuable than had I, you know, taken over the ice cream business and put franchises on the moon or something. I think the spiritual nature of what actually ended up taking place between us is something that I will always be very, very grateful for.
Right. I mean, it's easy for me to look at your story and kind of, you know, construct a narrative that makes this whole thing very obvious in retrospect. Like, this is clearly a hero's journey tale, you know, a father-son, you know, it's so Shakespearean or biblical. But I'm imagining that going through it, it really was, you know, leaning heavily on that spiritual guidance, because it must have seemed very foggy.
It was very foggy. It was very rough. I mean, he was very angry for a long time, and he didn't deal well with his anger. He didn't like it, and so he, you know, we didn't talk for years, and when we did, it was very tense, and he was just really, really angry at me. But you know, his own health got really bad, and then his doctor said he should read my book, and he. I guess his life was at stake in a way. And he started making changes, small ones at first, but he got some results and then made bigger changes and got more results. He ended up no longer, he wouldn't eat bacon and eggs for breakfast. Instead, he wanted oatmeal and orange juice and, you know, and prunes or something like that. And he started getting off the drugs. He'd been on these very, very strong meds for high blood pressure. And his blood pressure came down completely, didn't need the medication anymore. And his diabetes improved tremendously. He didn't, he got off the insulin, he got off the diabetic pills. I mean, it was quite a bit of healing in his whole insulin metabolism. And I lost a lot of weight that he needed to lose. He felt better than he had for a long time. His golf game improved about 8 strokes. I mean, everything was better. And, you know, he couldn't deny that this was working for him. And he stopped eating ice cream. He stopped eating sugar of any type. And, you know, I really do appreciate that he was able to make those changes. It certainly was heartwarming for me to see. And also I got to know him for maybe 20 more years than I would have otherwise.
Mm. So now it sounds like from your description of some of the rocky times in your relationship and just from the way he would talk that he was a man who was very good at pushing buttons in people.
Yes.
And so as I look at, you know, your work both in, you know, in Diet for a New America, which was a very, you know, it was fighting words, but it was very compassionate and peaceful. And the work you've done since then, including the food revolution work that you're doing now with your son Ocean, it's like you're not shying away from the fight, but you're doing it in a really peaceful way. I wonder if that was kind of your father's gift to you.
No, I wouldn't say so.
I mean the need to develop a peaceful.
Well, that maybe
response.
Yes, because I really he was a very aggressive guy and a boss. I mean, he was used to running a business where he had tens of thousands of employees, and those who spoke to him called him Mr. Robbins, and those to whom he spoke, he got called by their first name.
Mm-hmm.
He was used to being in the position of power, and then when in our society, when people have that kind of wealth, they get fawned on all over the place and indulged and in ways that are kind of bizarre, frankly. But and I don't think they're healthy for anybody, but that's what happens. And so, you know, he was very much used to being in charge. And when I had other ideas and other thoughts and other points of view to express, he wasn't always particularly receptive, to say the least. And he was old school in a lot of ways. But I did understand at some point, you know, I worked with Dr. King in the 60s. I marched with him. And I one of the things he said was that we needed to oppose the sin, but love the sinner.
Mm.
And I thought, well, that is easier said than done. You know, but it's worth aspiring in that direction, and maybe we can't reach it fully, but maybe we can take some steps towards it. And I thought, well, then we really do have to have compassion for those who don't have compassion. You know, we really do have to reach out to and include in our hearts and in our goodwill the people who are doing the things we oppose. And I don't pretend by any means or claim by any means to succeed at that all the time or even much of the time, but I do hold that as an ideal or a value or a guiding light. And I really do want to include as many people in the food revolution as possible. I don't like nutritional one-upmanship. I don't like the more vegan than thou, or more raw than you, or the these divisive, even polarizing attitudes that I see in activists and in people who feel very passionately about topics. But I think that the more passionately we feel about a subject, the more important it is to treat those who disagree with us with respect.
Hmm. And I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I figured that was your perspective when I look at the roster of speakers at this year's Food Revolution, including, you know, people who are no friend of veganism, like Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and many others. You know, I started, since the book's come out, I've started going to kind of vegan and vegetarian conferences.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I can totally see that ethical vegans, you know, view eating animals in any way, as any kind, as a form of slavery, as if they're abolitionists.
Yes.
And so I can see how they could look at me, who doesn't share their values, and feel like there's absolutely no compromise. There's no way to compromise to maybe, you know, give the slave weekends off, or give the slave air conditioning in their quarters. But, you know, but I still, just as a form of strategy, and just in terms of being truly cruelty free and nonviolent, I really resonate with the way you invite everyone to the initial conversation about how can we have a more just and loving food policy in our world.
Well, I look for what we have in common more than I look for where we disagree or differ. We can get to the points of disagreement later once we've established what we have in common, and that's the base, that's the foundation. Then we can deal with our differences as allies or as partners or as somehow colleagues in a work that's greater than any of us, as opposed to dealing with them from a more adversarial or polemical place. And I really want to be successful in this work. I don't mean personally. I want us to be successful. I want us to succeed creating a healthy society and a healthy future. And there's so much at stake in our very lifetimes. And the choices we make will have consequences that are just extravagant. And so when I don't have time, really. I don't think we can afford the luxury of petty divisiveness and that kind of self-indulgence. I think we really need to transcend those kind of black and white thinking ways in order to form more bridges with people. And it's actually a lot more fun too. I you know, when you're the president or guru of your own little cult, it's very boring and it's tiring. And, how much more fun to actually engage with the entire consciousness of the world and all of the people and all of the things that are taking place, and know every one of them is one of us in some profound sense. I really do look for that spark of spirit or of light in each and every person. It's sometimes very buried. It's submerged. It's distorted. I can't always find it. That's for sure. But mm-hmm. I look for it. I try.
Right. No matter how cloudy it is, there's a sun there somewhere, right?
Somewhere there's a sun. If there's a big pile of horse shit, well, there's got to be a pony around here somewhere.
Well, before we say goodbye, I'm just curious what you have planned for the next 55 years.
Well, that would take me to 120.
Right. I don't mean to curse you with a short life, but I just thought you might not look that far ahead.
You know, right now I am having a really great time working with Ocean, my son, on the Food Revolution Network. We've put on two summits, and they've been very, very wonderful events. This last one had 73,000 participants. They're growing rapidly. I'm loving working across these kinds of divides with food groups, food awakening groups, food movement groups, that maybe we have some things in common with and not other things, but fighting those things we do have in common and working with it for a common purpose. I really want to continue doing that. I'm not a purist who will only work with people who sign a purity pact and meet my standards of something. I will work with anyone who has goodwill and desires to see the world more loving place.
Hmm. Well, so for people who want to find out more about the food revolution, tell us how to go there.
Foodrevolution.org, www.foodrevolution.org.
Okay, and that includes, and I've been loving the emails I've been getting since I signed up.
Yeah, you can sign up there. It's free, and we don't ever give your name to anybody, or your contact info to anybody. We just will send you things like those emails you've been getting, and you can always unsubscribe. There's an easy thing to do at the bottom of every email to do that. We don't want to impose ourselves on anybody, but we do have the Food Revolution Network. Ocean and I founded it about a year and a half ago, and it has grown to over 140,000 members in a year and a half. It's growing fast, and it's an exciting thing to be involved with. I'm learning a lot from the whole process.
Mm. Yep, and it's definitely a part of the vanguard, especially because it connects so many people, as you said, who have, you know, enough in common. I think, you know, when I looked through the list, I thought everyone in that list, you know, wants us all to be healthier and happier.
Yes.
Nobody has an agenda that overrides that. And within that group, there are some significant differences. And yet, you know, let's have those fights in about 20 years when there's not a single animal living under factory farming conditions. Then let's go at it with the paleo people. Then bring it on.
Yeah. And you know, there's so many huge problems that we can address if we get over ourselves and get over our cynicism and get over our resignation and get over our belief in our impotence, and start to understand our real powers. To connect with one another and make a difference in this world. That's when, to me, the whole thing gets really exciting.
Right. So I just, you know, I want to close by saying, you know, that for years, I think, and I read your book when I was, you know, 23 or 24, roughly the same time as you kind of made your, the first step on your own hero's journey. And I think for many years, I really saw you as a kind of special role model. Like you were doing something that the rest of us wouldn't or couldn't do. And I think as I'm approaching 50 now, I'm getting more mature. I'm seeing your story as all of our story, that, you know, at whatever age, at whatever point, we all have this incredible power to choose a new life for ourselves and for our families, our society, and for the planet.
Well, we do, and I'm glad that you're seeing your own gifts manifesting now in all kinds of new ways and powerful ways, and it just continues to spread. Like we were saying at the very beginning, how contagious vitality and health is, and frankly, truth is. When people see the truth and understand it, it's hard to go back to sleep once you've woken up. You can doze a little bit, but you can't really forget. Mm. You know, once you've seen behind the curtain, seeing what's really going on, it's really hard to forget it. And so it kind of haunts you, and if you walk away from it and pulls you back, and pretty soon you're living a life of purpose and passion and power.
Well, John Robbins, it has been such an honor and a pleasure to share this time with you today. Foodrevolution.org for folks who want to find out more. And John, I so appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Howard.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize all the stuff that I do, is for you so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.